Hello and welcome. This is Inside Is Capital. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. Peter Berezin is here. Peter is the Chief Global Strategist and Director of Research at BCA Research, where he leads the firm's global investment strategy service and helps shape their big picture outlook on the economy and markets. He's also part of BCA's leadership team and has been central to building some of their flagship research products like the Equity Trading Strategy Service and the Macro Quant Model. Before BCA, Peter was a senior global economist at Goldman Sachs and earlier worked at the International Monetary Fund, where he contributed to the IMF's World Economic Outlook. He holds degrees in economics from McMaster University, the London School of Economics, and a PhD from the University of Toronto. With that background, Peter brings a rare blend of market insight, policy depth, and global perspective, making him one of the most important voices to listen to right now.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Peter, welcome. It is terrific to have you on the show. I'm excited to get your take.
Happy to be on the show.
Thank you for joining me. So, Peter, let's start right at the top. BCA has put the odds of a U.S. recession at 60% in the near term and raised the alarm on stagflation. Over the next 6 to 18 months, how do you see those risks playing out? And what specific signals will help you tell whether we're looking at just a quick dip or something more drawn out and stagflationary?
Yeah. Well, I think that the worries around stagflation and recession sort of part of a broader narrative. The impact of the tariffs is only now starting to kick in. If you look at the CPI, on a year-over-year basis in the U.S., it was 2.3% in April. Now we're at 2.7. If you look at the CPI swap market, which is sort of a market view of where inflation will be over the coming quarters, it's basically saying that inflation will be up to around 3.4, 3.5% by midway next year. And the problem is that employment growth is very stagnant. We've just got the payrolls, another weak print. And so if inflation is going up and nominal wage growth is coming down, which it has been for the last couple of years now, that means real income growth is going to be very, very weak. The savings rate is well below where it was prior to the pandemic. Delinquency rates on credit cards, auto loans are very, very high. So people can borrow more, which means that they have to spend on income. But if income isn't growing, then you're not going to see much consumption growth. And that's 70% of the economy. And that already kind of gives you a sense of where growth is likely to be.
Yeah. And do you think that possibly the Fed's imperative to target 2% is perhaps a little bit too They're not allowing for any flexibility. Like if the R-star rate is trending at a higher level and maintaining that trend, is it possible that the Fed is taking too strong of a stance on that 2% inflation target?
Well, the Fed is in a bind right now because they have two parts of their mandate, low employment and low and stable inflation, which is generally regarded as 2%. So the problem right now is that inflation is closer to 3 and full employment, we're probably there now, but in terms of where we're going, it seems as though we're moving away from that. We're moving towards higher unemployment. So they're in a bit of a bind, and that's the problem that you have when you have stagflation. Both sides of your mandate are in conflict with each other. My guess is that if we start to see a more meaningful increase in the unemployment rate, then the Fed will see that as the most important part of its mandate and focus on that. Now, if unemployment rises, inflation probably will come down, so that's a sensible strategy. The problem, however, is that you have all this political interference, tampering with the Fed's independence. And we don't know if that's going to impact longer term inflation expectations. So far, there hasn't been a big effect, to be frank. But the risk is that we start to see investors pricing more inflation over the long haul.
You're absolutely right. To your point, trade and fiscal policy have really dominated the story this year. Tariffs, in the range of, in and around 30% plus fiscal uncertainty is squeezing households and businesses. How do you expect those shocks to ripple through the economy and markets in the next year or two? Are there any knock-on effects that, most investors might not be factoring in yet?
Well, probably the best gauge of whether monetary policy is tight or not is what's happening to the housing market, because housing is the most interest rate sensitive part of the economy, and housing is struggling. Building permits are at multi-year lows. The inventory of new homes is back to where it was in late 2009. If you look at home builder confidence, it's very, very weak. And the problem is that these problems are not going to go away anytime soon, because you've got an affordability issue. Home prices are still quite high. They need to come down to make homes more affordable, but they're not going to come down significantly in the absence of recession. So you've got this housing market that remains basically frozen, and that's not good for the economy. So I'm certainly worried about the housing market. As I mentioned, I'm worried about income growth and what impact that will have on consumer spending. I'm also worried about the fact that capital spending outside of AI has been very, very weak. I mean, AI is doing well. Data centers are being built. But if you look at manufacturing construction more broadly, not just construction of data centers, you're seeing those numbers actually come down. Construction spending in the manufacturing area has been falling for close to a year. And you got to ask yourself, like, in the face of a trade war, are you really going to see much more construction? Because yes, it might make sense to build a factory if you think tariffs are going to last for a long time. But right now, there's no guarantee of that. The Supreme Court could nullify these tariffs. Future administration can nullify these tariffs. If you're going to build a factory, you better be certain that that factory will be profitable for many years. And right now, you don't have that certainty, so you're not seeing a lot of new construction.
Markets are quite happy considering a rate cut, but in reality, it signals something far worse.
Yeah, I mean, markets should be careful about what they wish for. I mean, yes, rate cuts, all things equal, are good. But if the economy doesn't need 300 basis points of cuts, which is what Trump is demanding, like immediately, and the Fed cuts rates anyway, well, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that investors will start to get more worried about inflation. Longer-term bond yields, which actually are more important to the economy than short-term rates, aren't going to fall. They might even rise. Yes, at that point, the Fed...
And they have risen. Yeah.
Exactly. They have risen.
In the face of rate cuts, the 10 and 30-year U.S. Treasuries have trended higher. I mean, the 30-year is sitting just below 5.
That's right.
That's not good for the mortgage market. That's not good. I mean, for the U.S. mortgage market, that's not good for, the debt situation.
That's right.
In terms of maintaining, and it feels kind of short-sighted from, the White House view that rates should be cut, to think that a rate cut would lead to lower longer term rates, when in fact it hasn't been the case to date.
That's right. I mean, a rate cut makes sense if the economy needs a rate cut. If it doesn't need a rate cut, you're going to see upward pressure on those longer term bond yields. Now people will say, well, okay, the Fed can always step in and buy those bonds. We can have more QE. I mean, yeah, there's nothing that forces the Fed to maintain QT. They could restart quantitative easing and buy more bonds. But if that happens, what's going to occur? What's going to occur is that inflation expectations will go up. We're going to get the making of a price wave spiral. And then at that point, you're going to have price controls. I mean, that's usually right. What happens, right? You start with financial repression, inflation rises, and then you have the government step in and say, you can't raise prices anymore. That's a killer for profit margins. So stock market investors need to kind of think through the steps. It's not just the first step rate cut. It's not even the second step of quantitative easing. It's the third step of what happens when you have economic chaos.
Yeah, it's very concerning. I mean, it should be more concerning than it has been. I think, you know, when you look at the way the market, I mean, the rates market has been volatile. Equities, of course, we know where they are. They're trending. They're sitting at all-time highs or near all-time highs. Let's talk a little bit about Fed policy and the inflation outlook. With inflation still running relatively hot and in relation to, you know, the Fed's stated target, we've kind of touched on the fact that the Fed's hands are tied already. Looking out 12 to 24 months, what's your base case for monetary policy?
So, you know, as you mentioned at the outset, I'm worried that the U.S. is heading into a recession. So when it comes to that word stagflation, I'm more concerned about the stag than deflation over the next 12 to 24 months, because ultimately what will happen is if unemployment rises, wage pressures will diminish further, and we probably won't have a sustained increase in inflation. My longer term concerns are, however, that after the recession ends and we start to get a recovery, then as long as we're still kind of in this environment where the Fed's independence being challenged, you know, a lot of these structural forces that have pushed down inflation, globalization, that's now on the back foot, the exodus of the baby boomers from the labor market, that's going to put a lot of upward pressure on inflation, because they're going to be spending, got a lot of wealth, but they're not going to be working and producing and earning an income anymore. So I think longer term, I'm much more worried about stagflation. Near term, I think the recession will probably kill off whatever inflation that we have.
Yeah. Peter, I just want to go back to some of the points you made with regards to reshoring. You mentioned, you know, like, for example, you know, CapEx. You mentioned, you know, the amount of spending. One example of these gigantic commitments that are being made by companies is the Apple commitment, you know, which was showcased with Tim Cook at the White House, the $500 billion commitment from Apple. And I mean, and, you know, the $100 billion plant commitment that they plan to build a plant. These verbal commitments are being made under the Trump administration. But if that all changes at the midterms or at the end of the Trump term, 3 years from now, those companies could easily walk back some of those plans or never see them come to fruition in the first place, only because they're watching the evolving landscape and, you know, they're watching how things are changing. They're watching how sentiment is changing. They're watching the possibility of a favorable, what could be deemed to be a favorable outcome in the midterms by some. You know, like a change in power in Congress and in the House, in the Senate and the House. What do you think? Do you have any thoughts on, I mean, it's kind of murky because, you know, you really can't see, but I think that's part of your thought process, right? Which is that those commitments could evaporate or never come to pass, never come.
And that's what we saw during Trump's first term.
Right.
The very high profile announcement by Foxconn pledging to build a big plant in Wisconsin. They had the ribbon cutting ceremony. I think even Trump showed up for that. Nothing happened. It's still like a vacant site. I mean, the reality is that you're not going to build a plant that's only going to be profitable if there are tariffs, unless you expect those tariffs to remain in place. And as you said, we don't know what's going to happen in the midterms. What we do know is that the Democrats are keen to vote for any bill that strips the president of his authority to unilaterally impose tariffs. The Republicans are still on Trump's side. But, you know, if the economy continues to slow, unemployment rises, and people are blaming the trade war, quite a lot of Republicans will then defect away from Trump, at least on this issue. And so we could see a bill pass with enough votes to override any veto. It's a possibility. We also, of course, don't know what's going to happen with the Supreme Court. And the point, of course, is that if you don't know what's the natural reaction, it's the same as the natural reaction that you have if you're driving into a fog. You slow down. You don't make rash decisions. And so if you're a company, you just sit on your hands and wait. And a lot of companies are doing that now.
Yeah, that feels exactly like what's been going on this year. You know, from our standpoint as well, which is that, you know, if we don't know what's coming, then we can wait. We don't have to do anything, but that hurts the economy. The removal of the de minimis exemption is hurting online, you know, on e-commerce globally. Now, with shipments coming from abroad to online consumers in the U.S., shipments are on hold because of the tariff question. Who's going to charge it? Who's going to pass that charge on? Is it going to be COD, or is it going to be at the post office? And post offices globally are holding on to packages. They're stopping online shipments because they don't want to be on the hook for the payments.
Yeah, and then that's been one of the ironies that Trump promised all this deregulation, and now you've got companies that, you know, forget about even managing the tariff shock. They don't even know what the tariffs are.
That's right.
Because there's
a lot of confusion.
And there's a lot of these sort of deals that are being made, but nothing in writing. It's a real mess for many, many companies.
Do you think markets are off in how they're pricing rate cuts? What does that mean? And what does that mean actually for treasuries, credit, and equities?
Well, I think markets are correct to price rate cuts. And certainly if there's a recession, then a lot of rate cuts should be priced in. So the bond market doesn't seem like kind of wildly off to me. It's the stock market that seems to be in kind of la-la land, kind of making this assumption that just because the Fed is going to cut rates, everything will be fine. I mean, look what happened in the past. The Fed began to cut rates in early 2000, recession started a few months later in 2001. The Fed began to cut rates in the summer of 2007. Recession started by the end of that year. Historically, Fed rate cuts have actually been harbingers of a recession, not because cutting rates hurts the economy, but because usually the Fed is too late. And right now, I think it's sort of the same story. The Fed, for understandable reasons, doesn't want to cut rates aggressively because inflation is still above target. But that means the monetary policy is still restrictive. The housing market is being hurt. And eventually, the labor market will buckle. Unemployment will start to rise. And that'll feed on itself. Higher unemployment will lead to less spending, leading to even less hiring and even higher unemployment.
So given your views, how are you thinking about allocation, about global allocation? You know, given that we have higher yields, slippage in the U.S. dollar, BCA has talked about leaning toward Europe and Asia where valuations look more attractive. How lasting do you think, first of all, this dollar weakness is? Like, I don't think, I suspect, you know, Canadians aren't that upset about, you know, the strengthening the Canadian dollar versus the U.S. dollar. But in terms of the economy, how lasting do you think the dollar weakness is, the U.S. dollar weakness is?
And the dollar has weakened by about 10% already. But if you look at where it's trading relative to its so-called purchasing power parity exchange rate, that's basically the exchange rate that equalizes the price of a basket of goods and services across countries. So it's sort of like the Big Mac index, but apply to all goods and services. The U.S. dollar is still about 17% expensive relative to that measure. So it does have scope to fall over to the long haul. Now, of course, the caveat here is that other countries also have fairly significant challenges. Government debt is not just high in the U.S., it's high across many countries. In Europe, it's high in Japan, it's high in a lot of other economies as well. And so, you know, in that sort of environment, even though the dollar doesn't look good, other currencies don't necessarily look greater, better. What looks good is like gold, which is why we've
moved
on gold, because that's sort of the safer currency, if you want to call it a currency. But yeah, I think that kind of gets to this, you know, question that you asked earlier. If we do have a recession, like how deep will it be? One thing that's kind of unique about the current situation is that we're starting at a point where the budget deficit in the U.S. is already 7% of GDP. And with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, it's on its way to 8% of GDP, even if there's no recession. If you have a recession, then tax revenues are going to come down, spending on Medicaid and other social programs is going to go up. You could have a budget deficit of 9-10% of GDP very, very quickly. And then you have to ask yourself, like, are bond yields going to fall in the way that they normally do during a recession? It's hard to know, right? Even if they do fall, they might not fall as much as they normally would. And so there is a risk that the bond market kind of does something maybe not too dissimilar to what it did in Europe in 2012. And that is sort of revolt at the prospect of these large unfunded fiscal deficits for as far as the eye can see. And if that happens, then we're not talking about a mild recession anymore. We're talking about a fairly severe one.
Looking around the globe, where do you see the most compelling opportunities right now or the biggest traps over the next cycle?
Well, I think in general, stocks are the biggest trap right now. They're more expensive in the U.S. than elsewhere, but even elsewhere, they're not that cheap. So you can make a case for Europe and Asia kind of in relative terms, but the U.S. stock market falls. Like, those markets are also going to decline, maybe not much, but they're still going to decline. So I think you want to be in safer places. I think, as I said, you want to be in gold, you want to be in like more defensive currencies, cheaper currencies like the Japanese yen. The yen usually strengthens if there is a major global growth shock that happened during COVID, that happened during the global financial crisis. So there are areas where you can hide. But right now, I don't think it makes sense to be too defensive. Now, having said that, you know, the model that I've sort of been using for the last year or so is like, wait until you see the whites of the recession's eyes before you go fully defensive. So I've been recommending a modest defensive stance. I think that's appropriate given where valuations are. But usually you don't want to get defensive too early, because usually stocks go up. And so I think right now, being a little bit underweight stocks relative to cash, that's perfectly fine. But wait until you start to see clear evidence of recession before you go fully defensive.
Right. I mean, because it might be premature.
Exactly. And usually
the
best time to be in the stock market is just when the party is getting going. And often the party will then end, but you don't want to sort of miss that last hurrah. So, I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. You have people with asset allocation. It really depends on how nimble you are. If you're like a longer-term investor, I think now is a good time to get a little bit more cautious. If you're tactical, if you can sort of get in and out of the stock markets, then play the moves. You might even make some money, but keep your finger near that sort of eject button.
Yeah, I think, looking at how equities have performed and continue to perform this year, as a follow-on from last year's performance, it's been very unexpectedly good, and it has climbed the markets. Markets have climbed this wall of worry that we've had this year, much to probably to the surprise of many. And when you stop and think that, like, if you look at something like a traditional 60-40 portfolio, the equity portion of the the equity sleeve has performed swimmingly, and it's the fixed income sleeve that's been very, that has become complex mm-hmm. to navigate. Mm-hmm. Are there, you know, and I'm curious, like, you know, you mentioned, of course, you know, taking an allocation in gold and, you know, to, how much stock are you putting in to the idea that there's a real concern over currency debasement? Do you put any stock in that?
I think you have to put some stock in that. I don't want to sort of get too radical with my view, because we know that inflation is very, very unpopular. We saw that in 2021. Unemployment is very, very low, but consumer sentiment was very weak because people were angry about inflation. So there is a political constraint to how much inflation you can engineer before you get kicked out of office. But certainly it's also true that when you have large budget deficits, you got to make tough choices. You either need to raise taxes or cut spending. That's not popular either. And so there is often a tendency for our politicians just to kick the can down the road and not really act until the market forces them to. And if you're an investor, you don't want to be there exposed to stocks when the market riots.
Exactly. And do you have any strategic ideas in terms of you know, with given all of the uncertainty that we've covered in our conversation so far, do you have any strategic allocation ideas that would be productive in sort of preparing the preparing portfolio for the turns in the market? I know you just said wait till you see the whites of their eyes, right? So you could either take a tactical, a tactical approach or a strategic approach or a blend of both. Are there any strategic allocations that come to mind that would be, you know, that would go to not only providing some return in the interim, like defensive strategies, diversifiers that would provide, you know, either income or growth, in the lead up, to a turn in the market, but also provide the defense that investors are thinking of right now. I mean, the sun is still shining, right? We've got a strong equity market, which is typically the growth driver of, you know, traditional portfolios, most investors' portfolios. You don't want to be like, in terms of adding diversifying assets to a portfolio, you definitely don't want to wait either until you need those diversifiers. You know, you don't want to wait till you're saying, I wish I had diversified some of those gains in equities away from the equity sleeve and into something uncorrelated. Do any strategic diversifiers come to mind?
Yeah, so there's a few that I would sort of mention. You know, we've generally been big fans of defense stocks because we are unfortunately, in a world where conflict is becoming more common and countries that previously didn't have to invest in defense are doing so, that very clearly in Europe, but also to some extent in Canada and elsewhere. So we're kind of bullish on the defense sector. I would also say that healthcare is starting to look a little bit more enticing. If you look at kind of sales amongst healthcare companies, they've been fine, no problems at all. The earnings have really come down as profit margins have collapsed. I think we're probably getting close to a bottom for healthcare margins. The secular outlook for healthcare is very, very strong because of population aging. I'd also add that AI is going to radically reshape healthcare, open up new drug discovery opportunities, allow for the automation of a lot of healthcare services. So definitely opportunities there. And finally, I would say kind of on a secular horizon, I like the idea of being in some natural resources. So I mentioned gold, but I would also add copper to that list. despite what's happening with some of Trump's kind of anti-green policies, we are in the midst of a transformation towards electric vehicles. AI is going to need a massive amount of new electrical capacity. So you need to build those power lines, you need to build those utility plants.
Right.
That's great for things such as copper. And there's a shortage of copper in the world. You know, in contrast to, say, oil, where prices go up and shale producers just pump out more oil, it takes 20 years to build a copper mine. And a lot of these copper mines are in geopolitically fraught locations. So we could have a structural shortage of copper and some other base minerals. And so probably there's a secular bull market that's likely to emerge once the economy comes out of any possible recession.
Thank you, Peter. That's good. That's very clarifying. I'm curious to know what your, if you have any strategic thoughts for the fixed income problem. You know, like we spent the last 20 years or 40 years, if you want to go back to the, you know, to the beginning of the peak of interest rates, you know, to the trough that we had last decade, in yields, that is, you know, we got accustomed to investing in duration.
Yeah.
Right. Of any kind. Like even if you go to the, you know, the belly of the curve, 5 years, even a 5-year bond, whether it's government or corporate, is going to cause problems for investors if yields continue to, you know, stay high or go a little bit higher. The so-called normalizing of rates, normalizing of yields. Do you have any allocation ideas for investors, looking to protect themselves from duration, for example, while seeking yield? Are there any ideas there?
So right now I wouldn't be increasing duration significantly. I think we're going to get a tactical opportunity to buy bonds if the economy does enter a recession, because regardless of what's happening to inflation and other variables, if the economy is in recession, bond yields probably are going to fall. I worry about, as I mentioned earlier, what happens when you come out of the recession. Do people that focus on these structural debt problems? They probably will. Now, the thing is, how those problems are resolved is uncertain. If you ask kind of a conceptual question, like, is high government debt good for bonds or bad for bonds? Is it inflationary, deflationary? The answer always is going to depend on politics. If you have high debt, one way to bring it down is by cutting spending, raising taxes. That hurts aggregate demand. That leads to less inflation, and that's good for bond yields. Another option, of course, is to just inflate away that debt, reduce the real value of the debt by cutting prices in the economy. And what happens ultimately boils down to politics. Now, it's not inevitable that we're going to have debt monetization. As I said, inflation is very politically unpopular. There are, you know, alternatives. Like Canada, for example, had a debt problem in the early 1990s. We didn't have massive inflation. Rather, we had like the general sales tax, you know, cuts to unemployment insurance under the Liberal government, you know, above all things. And bond yields in Canada went down for many, many years. So it depends on your political views. What I would say is that the market's not really pricing in much inflation over the long haul. If you look at these, you know, 30-year CPI swaps, or if you look at long-term break-evens, they're basically saying that inflation will be around 2%. That's probably too complacent. So while I want to get bullish on duration, if we have evidence of recession, after that recession ends, I think I'm going to be much more circumspect.
And what would you do as far as reducing duration in the fixed income sleeve? Are there any areas that you would turn to that are more favorable in the fixed income market that can solve, you know, the dilemma of, you know, investors aren't stretching for yield, you know, the front end of the yield curve is still high. the long end of the yield curve is higher. but where, you know, in terms of fixed income, in terms of the areas of fixed income, are there any strategic decisions that would help to offset some of that duration concern? Like, for example, in the alternatives arena, or is there anything that you know, balances out the fixed income sleeve so that you're not, so that you're able to pursue higher yields, but without the duration risk?
Well, I think right now cash is king. I mean, you still get pretty decent yields in the U.S. Now that, you know, is going to come down as the Fed cuts rates, but you know, for the next 6 to 12 months, I think it does make sense to have somewhat larger than normal cash holdings. If you're going to sell off of stocks, you can use that cash to buy stocks. So it's good to have it handy. I wouldn't be wading into corporate debts. I mean, yes, there's some companies like Microsoft that, in some sense, have better balance sheets than the U.S. government does. But if there's a fiscal crisis in the U.S., you know, one avenue will be for the government to get its hands on some of those private sector assets. So it's not necessarily going to be the case that corporate debt will do well in that type of environment. If there's a recession, corporate debt is going to do very, very poorly. Corporate spreads right now are actually very, very, very low.
Yeah, very tight.
Very, very tight. Even right
as you're paying for it.
So you're not really buying yourself much of a defensive allocation by being in corporate debt at the moment. You just got to wait. I think you want to park your money into assets that will tend to go up. I mentioned, you know, gold, mentioned the Japanese yen. Certainly there are kind of safer parts of the stock market. The consumer staples have really been getting hit, at least in relative terms. They probably will outperform if there's a recession in an equity bear market.
Okay. You talked about AI and productivity. I mean, you mentioned, we sort of touched on it. AI, artificial intelligence, AI is being hailed as the next big driver of productivity, with the potential to reshape industries and long-term growth. I think that's, you know, those are probably some of the most obvious hot talking points on the AI front. Do you see AI meaningfully lifting trend growth in the U.S. and globally? I know you mentioned there was a there's been a kind of a rollover in manufacturing investment, right? Yeah. I mean, the investment
outside,
in AI,
outside of AI, yeah.
Outside of AI has rolled over.
Yeah.
Or, you know, are we at risk? Conversely, are we at risk of repeating past cycles of overhyped technology like the, you know, the tech wreck?
Yeah, I think that risk is real. It's important. The thing about AI is that we don't know when the productivity gains will materialize. I'm sure eventually AI is going to have a meaningful impact on productivity, but it might just take longer than people realize. And Robert Solow, Nobel Prize winning economist, famously said in 1987 that you can see the computer age everywhere, but in the productivity statistics, meaning that at that time, PCs were being broadly deployed and yet productivity growth basically staying where it was previously. And Sowell thought that was a real puzzle. Now, eventually, we did have a productivity boom in the U.S.
Right.
And that it did occur because of the progress in computers, computer networking, the internet, and so on. But it started in 1995, like 7 years after Sowell made those remarks. And so the risk is that AI does boost productivity, but it just takes a lot longer. If you look at, say, output per hour worked, it's basically still in line with its pre-pandemic trend. It hasn't deviated much from where it was prior to ChatGPT. So that's one question.
Right.
Like, how long does it take for those productivity gains to materialize? The other question, which is more relevant for investors, is that if that productivity gain does occur, will it translate into profits? Because again, we think about what happened during the dot-com period. Productivity began to improve in 1995 and stayed high for about 10 years. So you had this 10 years of above normal productivity growth. Ironically, it wasn't until 2005, just when productivity growth was starting to come down, that the profits from the internet finally exploded. So there was a lag of 10 years between the productivity and the profits. And when those profits did begin to materialize, what drove them? The answer was monopoly power. And so you have to ask yourself, like, is AI going to lead to the sort of monopoly power that investors need to justify current valuations? And I'm not sure whether it will or not. The thing about companies such as Meta, Google, Microsoft, is that they basically have monopolies in the industry. They have those monopolies because they take advantage of things like network effects. You know, in the case of Instagram or YouTube, people use these platforms because everybody else uses them. Doesn't really apply to AI. I don't interact with other users when I use ChatGPT.
That's right.
I interact with the AI itself. And similarly, you don't have the economies of scale that you have with social media or search or software in general. Like software, you create a program and then replicating it is free. With AI, you got to buy the NVIDIA chips. You got to build the data centers. There's a lot of CapEx that has to go into AI. And so AI could end up being very important for productivity, just like airlines are very important for productivity. We wouldn't have a globalized world without airlines, and yet they never make any money because they're CapEx intensive and they don't have a really differentiated business model. That could actually happen with AI. That's the risk.
It sounds almost like a utility.
Could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean,
right? I mean, it to see the gains from it is there's so much promise in it, but to actually see that come to pass, you can see obviously for NVIDIA to continue to produce the chips, that's a very profitable business for NVIDIA. But if the growth level's off in, you know, the building out of servers, the building out of data centers, then, you know, there's capacity issues, right? There's issues of growth disappointing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And of course, the trillion dollar question for investors is like, when does that happen? Like, when do investors say to themselves, oh, wait a second, maybe the money from AI won't be quite as copious as we thought, which is exactly what they said during the early 2000s when the dot-com bubble burst. Now,
yeah, and there was a lost decade in there.
There was a lost decade. And so the question is, what sort of metrics should you look at? We've written some reports on this question. Looking at CapEx is not going to help you very much. CapEx is very lagging. Now, by the time firms cut their CapEx spending, the stock market will already have fallen. That's what happened, by the way, in 2022 had a bear market in stocks. The CapEx actually didn't peak until the end of that year when stocks were already bottoming.
Right.
What you want to look at is not CapEx. What you want to look at is free cash flow, because free cash flow usually peaks before the stock market peaks. That's what happened in 2022. The free cash flow peaked in the third quarter of 2021. I'm talking about the free cash flow of these big tech companies. Also, what happened during the dot-com boom, the free cash flow of the telecom producers, the telecom companies peaked at the end of 1999. The bear market started in the spring of 2000, and the CapEx only really ended in early 2021 when the recession had already begun. So you want to look at that cash flow and the punchline here is that if you look at those cash flow numbers for the hyperscalers, they're now starting to fall, which is kind of telling us that maybe we're getting close, not necessarily to the CapEx spending on data centers, but we're getting close to what matters more for investors, which is what happens to the stock market.
Yeah. So Peter, how should investors think about you know, how should investors consider all these factors, you know, as they would impact on profits and valuations over the coming years? I mean, you know, we all know what happened to companies like, you know, Qualcomm. Global Crossing, of course, disappeared, but Cisco Systems, you know, 20 years of nothing, right? I mean, you could have bought Cisco Systems in the peak of the dot-com era and made zero returns on it if you continued to own it for two decades.
Yeah, so right now we have there's a bit of a
like great companies, but terrible stocks,
exactly.
Possibly, right? Yeah.
The two are not always the same.
Yeah.
So what's happening now is that, you know, every time NVIDIA sells a chip, it books a big profit. But then when Microsoft buys that chip, it's not a cost to Microsoft, it's CapEx.
Right. Right.
It's only going to get expensed over the long term. So overall profits go up from that transaction, even if all that's really happening is the cash is moving from one pocket to another pocket. So that's why you want to look at the free cash flow. And that, as I said, that is now starting to deteriorate. Like, no one knows when the music will stop. I think it's impossible to predict these things. So if you're nimble, if you're tactical, you know, look at a moving average rule, and if stocks fall below it, get out. That might be sort of the easiest way to do this. Now, BCA, we try to be a little bit more rigorous. We've got this macro quant model that brings together hundreds of leading indicators for stocks, bonds, currencies, commodities, leading indicators that have to do with the economy, sentiment, positioning, monetary and financial conditions. Right now, kind of that model is saying that stocks probably are going to be okay for the next month or two. But if we're talking about like a 12-month horizon, the risks are to the downside. So I'll reiterate what I said before. You know, keep your finger close to that exit button.
Right. And I mean, we're in September, Peter. It's the most volatile month of the year.
That's right.
Right? Historically. Any parting thoughts, Peter?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think, you know, I've been in this business long enough, and sometimes I see what I would kind of characterize as these Wile E. Coyote moments for markets, where it's clear something has gone wrong. We've had now 4 months of very weak employment data. Housing is in real pain. Large parts of the economy are struggling. And stocks are like, eh, who cares if it doesn't affect Nvidia's earnings, doesn't affect Meta's earnings, if it doesn't affect Google's earnings, who cares? That, I think, is a very naive notion. We're going to see cuts to AI CapEx if there is a recession. Certainly, if you're like Meta or Google and you depend very heavily on advertising spending, companies are going to be cutting back on advertising if there is a recession. So the tech stocks are not going to be immune. In other words, Coyote has gone over the cliff. It's just a question until it looks down and sees that there's nothing.
Yeah, excellent. That's a great analogy or great metaphor. I mean, you know, I remember watching those Saturday morning cartoons and wondering if those, you know, if Wile E. Coyote could ever get hurt.
never did. Always recovered.
Yeah. Peter, thank you. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been great having you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.